The Ebola virus that's taking so many lives in West Africa was first recognised in 1976. Since that time, it's caused multiple large outbreaks, which have become more frequent since 1990. The 2014 Ebola epidemic is the largest in history, affecting multiple countries in West Africa, including Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. With over 10,000 cases to date, many organisations are now involved in dealing with the crisis, from the UN, WHO, the CDC, to non-governmental organisations or NGOs who've been working in these countries for a number of years. On today's show, we bring you a special report from several of those NGOs to give us an insider's look at the Ebola crisis. Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. For most of the world, a lot has been learned about Ebola since this epidemic began. Here's a review from CNN.
The clock ticking from the moment the Ebola virus enters the body. The disease, not easy to contract, only carried in bodily fluids, blood, saliva, mucus, sweat, tears, semen, vomit, urine, or feces. And it can only enter the body through direct contact with cuts or abrasions on the skin, or through the eyes, nose, mouth, throat, or reproductive organs. People can also get infected when eating meat from or coming in contact with contaminated animals. The virus can survive several hours in a dried state on doorknobs or countertops. If the fluid remains wet and at room temperature, it can survive for days outside the body. Most people get it through contact with bodily fluids of patients or the deceased. But when is someone with Ebola actually contagious? The short answer, when they start to show symptoms. Those symptoms, though, can take from 2 to 21 days to kick in. In other words, a person could travel and interact with others for days, weeks, without passing on the virus. The average incubation period is 8 to 10 days. The early symptoms of the disease, fever, weakness, muscle pain, headache, and sore throat, are often mistaken for the flu, malaria, typhoid fever, or dysentery. But then things get worse. Vomiting, bloody diarrhea, often internal and external bleeding, skin rashes, and purple spots on the skin. Once the symptoms set in, the person is contagious and has 6 to 16 days to either beat the virus or die. The death rate, high, 50 to 90% chance of death depending on the strain and access to medical care. If an infected patient with a strong immune system gets proper care, the chance of surviving goes up. But if they survive, the virus could remain in the semen for up to 3 months. And if you survive, you have immunity for at least 10 years. But what's still unknown, if you're immune from other strains of Ebola. Answers and questions for a frightening disease.
A frightening disease indeed. On today's show, we have our usual lineup of cooking and personal stories, along with a number of great guests. But first, the news. In the headlines today, ethical questions about the outbreak and how to stop Ebola. The Pellegrino Center for Clinical Bioethics in Washington, D.C. asked some hard questions in an article this week. The author pointed out that ZMapp is an experimental drug that has never been tested in humans. Yet it's been given to 6 people, of whom 2 died. So is it helpful or harmful? And if we had any left, who should get it, healthcare workers or others? The author argued that healthcare workers could at least give informed consent before becoming guinea pigs in this rather unusual clinical trial. And also, because they had already risked their lives to save others, they also deserved it. The next question was, should foreign healthcare workers who are exposed or infected be brought home while Africans are left to die? The argument could be made that the reason they're in Africa is to help a poor healthcare system. So it would be unjust to leave them to suffer the consequences of that poor healthcare system, which they were actually trying to help. Besides, if they were left there, it would discourage others who might otherwise be willing to go and help. Finally, Africa has faced Ebola outbreaks for almost 40 years, so why is there still no vaccine? Probably because Africa is a small and unrewarding marketplace, yet the size and rapidity of this epidemic seems to have pricked the conscience of the developed world. Or is it rather than helping our brothers, the effort is now focused on protecting ourselves? Regardless, let's do what we can to help the immediate needs of those affected and to help equalise these gross inequalities. The chance of an infected patient transmitting Ebola to others is 3 to 4 times higher than those dying of Ebola, compared with those who survive. Analysis of incidence and fatality records from Liberia are showing that on average each victim infects another 1.7 people. However, an Ebola survivor infects on average 0.7 people, whereas each non-survivor infects 2.4 people. And those transmissions occur later in the course of the disease. Based on this analysis, researchers have calculated the isolation of 75% of infected people within 4 days of symptoms could convey a high chance of eliminating the disease. But with hospitals filled to overflowing and a healthcare workforce spread so thin, that's easier said than done. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Health News. First organised medical work by the Seventh-day Adventist Church began in 1866, and today it operates more than 570 healthcare institutions around the world. My first guest is Dr. Peter Landless, Health Director for the Seventh-day Adventist World Church. My other guest is Deborah Olson, Emergency Programs Assistant for Adventist Development and Relief Agency, or ADRA. With a presence in over 120 countries, ADRA is on the ground in Liberia, where Ebola is hitting the hardest. To start the conversation, I asked Dr. Landless about the work that the Adventist Church has been doing in West Africa even before Ebola struck.
Well, we've had work in two major places, and that is in Waterloo Hospital in Sierra Leone and also in Monrovia, Liberia, in Cooper Hospital. Both those hospitals have been running for a number of years now, and both have been working or had been working until the Ebola virus started to take its toll.
Okay, now, Deborah, what was ADRA doing prior to the Ebola crisis in this region?
Well, as you know, both countries have recently experienced somewhat severe civil war. And so a lot of what ADRA was doing was helping to rebuild the infrastructure in the countries. One long-running project has been an educational capacity building, training teachers, providing books, curricula, things of that nature. And also working on agricultural development, especially at the household level, kitchen gardens, household gardens, as well as general agricultural development.
Now, Dr. Landless, you also work with WHO. You were at their building when they called the Ebola emergency meeting. That must have been interesting.
It was indeed. I was not there for that particular meeting. I was there for the release of the world report on suicide, but at the same time they were having the emergency crisis meeting on Ebola. They've only had two emergency sessions at the World Health Organization in its history. One was for HIV and AIDS, and the second one has been over Ebola. And it's causing a tremendous amount of response, reaction, stretching of resources. It's a huge, huge crisis. And Margaret Chan, who's the Director General, called it a huge crisis, which can be resulting ultimately in failure of states, failed states because of the problem. So we're looking at a really significant crisis right now.
We are looking at a huge crisis. We've got multiple humanitarian agencies working. Deborah, how does ADRA integrate with all these other humanitarian aid agencies, the UN, WHO? How do you know where the gaps are, that you're not overlapping with others? How does that all work?
Communication. There's definitely a level of communication that goes on at a consistent basis, whether there's a crisis or not, attending meetings, coordinating with other organizations, but also at the UN level. And standard procedure when there is an emergency of any kind is to initiate heightened communication, both based around sectors, for example, health or food or water and sanitation, as well as headquarter to field level offices. We make sure that we have meetings on our side of the ocean at this level, coordinating with other United States-based organizations, European organizations. And our colleagues in the field are doing the same, and we also coordinate with each other. So lots of talking.
Probiotics are important in enhancing immune function. They also make great food. So right after the break, I'll show you how to put them to work in your kitchen.
I love eating cultured food.
Cultured food?
Yeah, this is a culture medium in which a large colony of friendly bacteria live. And when I eat them, they go into my tummy and they help me digest my food, assimilate my nutrients, and they boost my immune system.
So is that like blue cheese? I used to work in a restaurant, and I made blue cheese dressing about 30 gallons a week. I'd take these big wheels of blue cheese, grind them up, and the smell would permeate the whole restaurant, and the waitresses would come back and complain. I thought you said they were friendly.
Yeah, well, you have to consider the colony that you're eating.
Well, how do you know?
In your case, it's unfriendly.
Well, how do you know the difference?
Well, you think about it. Cheese causes headaches, migraines, irritability, indigestion, and poor sleep.
That sounds pretty unfriendly to me.
Exactly, very unfriendly. And those bacteria are actually not good for your intestinal microflora.
Well, not only that, the cheese is cultured for many months, severely oxidizing the cholesterol.
Right, and oxidized cholesterol is lethal to your arteries. Within 24 hours, you're already starting to develop clogs.
So coming back to friendly bacteria, are you saying that there's a war going on in our gut between the friendly bacteria and the pathogens?
That's right, there is. And if we have antibiotics, we wipe everything out and we have to start all over again. That's when the battle really rages. And so it's important. The other thing is we have a very hygienic lifestyle. And so we don't carry as many bacteria probably as we used to. So it becomes even more important to replace the bacteria in our guts with friendly stuff.
So if I eat this yogurt, will I be a cultured man?
Well, at least on the inside. Doctor's orders.
Thanks, Doc. I'll eat to that.
Me too.
Today in Go Healthy's Kitchen, I'm going to teach you something that I eat every day, and I'm sure every one of you has had it at least once in your lifetime, and that's yogurt. Now, for those of you that want to avoid dairy, it's really nice to know how to make a non-dairy yogurt. I'm allergic to dairy, so for me, this is my absolute necessity every morning for breakfast. And what we're going to use is a type of soy milk. There are a number that will work for making yogurt, but not all of them will. Joining me in the kitchen to help me today is Yamil. Yamil, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Good. It's good to have you. Now, do you like yogurt?
Yes.
Yeah? What's your favorite flavor?
Mango.
Mango. Oh, why don't we make some mango yogurt today? Would you like that?
Yes.
Good. Now, what we've done is we've poured some of this soy milk into our container. And it's not easy to find yogurt makers because people don't tend to make yogurt because it's so readily available on the shelves, isn't it? You go to the supermarket, how many flavors do you have?
A lot,
that's right. But what we're going to do is teach people how to do that because it's good to know. Do you know why it's good to have yogurt?
Because it's healthy.
It's healthy for you. And it's healthy for you because it contains a culture
And in our bacteria, in our gut, we have bacteria. And it's good to have friendly ones because otherwise the unfriendly ones take over. So this is a really important recipe to have. Good to have some every day. So we've poured our soy milk into our container. And then we're going to use this starter. And it's called kefir. And kefir is one I use because it's pretty reliable at working. You can use a live yogurt that you would pour in a quarter cup of live yogurt into here and it might work. This one will definitely work. So why don't you sprinkle that into the milk for me and sprinkle the whole sachet in. And what you're going to want to do is sprinkle that gently so it all stirs around, doesn't form a big blob. That's perfect, right out to the edges. Because if it forms a big blob, it's not going to mix right through the milk and end up causing it to culture all the way through. Is that empty yet? Not quite?
No.
No? Just hold it for a minute. We can put the lid on and we can mix that up. See how much is left in that sachet there. And we're just going to mix that really well. And you can see it there, can't you? You can see the blobs of powder there that you're going to want to get to mix right through. We might have to give it a little shake. But I always say, you know, it's alive, so don't shake it too hard. You might break it.
Okay.
All right, how much is left in there? Let's see. Oh, we've still got a bit. Okay, we're going to open the lid and pour a little bit more in. You ready? Okay, there you go. We want to make sure all of it is in. Perfect. Okay. And we're going to mix that up again, maybe even top it up with a little bit of milk. Don't fill it too full because it expands in the heat and you end up bursting through the lid. So we're going to pop that in. You can use a preserving a canning jar. That also works well. I have this little system, which I didn't get here in America. I got that from elsewhere. But basically, it's like a thermos flask. And what we do is we're going to pour boiling water in there.
What does it do?
What this does is it's going to keep that milk nice and warm for as long as we leave it in there.
Okay.
So there we go. So this is insulated on the outside. We pop our yogurt in there and we're going to put the lid on and then we leave it just like that for 8 hours. And when we come back, we have a nice creamy yogurt. See that? That milk turned into yogurt. And you can have it plain, isn't it? Doesn't it look good? Shall we make some mango yogurt just for you?
Yes.
All right, we're going to take about a cup of yogurt, add about half a cup of fruit, or you can mix it up however you want. Now, if I give this to you, can you blend it up for us?
Yes.
It's going to be a yogurt smoothie, isn't it? There you go. You want to pop that on the machine and just let it drop in and press it down and turn it. Perfect, that's it. There we go. There we go. We've got mango yogurt.
Okay.
Lovely. Shall we try it? I'm dying to try it.
Okay.
There. One for you. And one for me. Okay, let's see. Taste it. Tell me what you think.
Delicious.
Oh, isn't it good? And you can have that on your breakfast every day and get those healthy cultures going. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and helping me make the yogurt.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Our topic today is Ebola. Here's a story of survival produced by AFP News.
The ongoing Ebola epidemic sweeping West Africa is yet to hit Uganda. But Murgawa Sibiti, who lives just outside the capital Kampala, knows the virus all too well. He contracted Ebola from his brother in October 2012, spending the best part of the next month fighting for his life.
First, blood started to come out from everywhere, from every single part of my body. It was horrible.
At the time, I was with a relative, and they took me to Mulago Hospital, where they helped me.
Mergawa's wife, brother, sister and sister-in-law all caught Ebola and all died. He now lives with his mother, who refers to the period as the tragedy. Although grateful to be alive, the virus took a toll on his finances as well as his health.
When I was sick, I spent all the money I had to treat my family and myself. I even had to borrow money from friends. When I came back from the hospital, I had to pay the money back. I sold everything I had.
Mergawa was initially shunned by his community. He had to appeal to doctors to convince his neighbors that he was no longer infectious because suspicion around the virus is rife.
People in the area, first they thought it was from the witch doctors. So the first people who got that Ebola, they took them to the witch doctors to see that they can be treated from there. So we didn't know that it was Ebola.
Mergawa was treated at Mulago Hospital in Kampala, where today health workers are on high alert should cases of Ebola re-emerge.
I don't scare people, but I give the truth. Okay?
Although there hasn't been a case of Ebola in Uganda since 2012, when up to 14 people died, Ugandan health officials were monitoring 5 people after one man died in September from the Ebola-like Marburg virus, which, like Ebola, is spread through bodily fluids. For Mergawa, the re-emergence of Ebola in Africa brings back the tragedy of the past and fresh fears for the future.
Fresh fears, because there are no proven antiviral agents or vaccines yet for Ebola. I asked Dr. Landless how chances of survival can be improved when treatment is so limited.
The only way at the moment to improve chances of survival is to start early intervention. Early intervention means recognition of the disease, and of course that's a real problem because in the area where this disease is found, particularly there are other problems like malaria, and they can masquerade one as the other. However, the earlier the intervention, the better, and there's just been a very interesting editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine where they talk about, despite the fact that there are not enough proven therapies, as you said, antivirals or anything, early intervention, early rehydration, and this is part of the problem because people are reticent to apply intravenous therapy because they don't want to get infected with the body fluids and so on. It's of absolute and vital importance that people are seen as soon as possible and are treated as soon as possible, and particularly with the rehydration. Once they lose volume, and that's crucial as far as blood pressure is concerned and survival is concerned, then all the other issues related to infection, bleeding, bacterial infections, which come in as well, can terminate the patient's life. So despite the fact that we don't have absolute antivirals or directed therapy, it's important to start intervention of support as soon as possible.
Right, because what we're seeing is fatality rates around 50% in Africa, yet here in the US, I know we've only had a few cases, but it's like 12%. So that's got to be part of the reason, because we don't have any extra, as you say, any of the fancy technology yet.
Correct.
Although it's being trialled, it's not.
Well, they treated two physicians that came out of the area with ZMapp and found that that worked. However, two is not enough, because when you look at a mortality rate of about 50%, you have to treat many more patients to show that that is actually the reason that they survived. So early intervention, careful nursing is where it's at.
Now, Deborah, out in West Africa, early intervention is not the top of the local population's list of things to do, is it? What's going on there?
Well, we all know what it feels like when we're sick. We want to be taken care of. We want loved ones around us. We want to be comfortable and feel safe. And what happens when you have Ebola is you need to be removed from everyone else, because by being near them, you increase the chance of their being exposed and and infected by the virus. So when someone is suspected to have Ebola infection, they're removed from their family, from their friends, from their entire support structure, and they're isolated, often in a very scary environment. If you've seen any of the pictures, obviously, it looks like a spacesuit that people wear around you. And for people who aren't comfortable often with Western medicine, this can be often very frightening. I know I would be frightened if I were sick and someone wearing this were taking care of me. So not only are they removed from everything that's comfortable and friendly, but there's a good chance that they may never come back. As Dr. Landless said, there's a 50% mortality rate at least.
Right, and if they do die, then their body is not returned to the family.
Exactly. And that's, we all understand what it is to grieve for someone. And the way that the custom is to grieve in West African countries is very different from ours, but it's also a way that the infection is transmitted more easily. And so once the patient has been taken away, oftentimes they'll never come back even to allow the family to grieve.
I had such a poignant interview with an individual recently from West Africa who, when we were talking about the issues related to death, dying, dealing with the corpses and so on, he said, people don't seem to understand. He said, my mother-in-law died in my arms, not from Ebola, but died in my arms, and I carried her to the mortuary. That was my privilege and my duty. He said, we grieve, as you've just so correctly said, differently. And there's been a fair amount of criticism and misunderstanding of the cultural approaches. And this is something I think we really need to take into account and to be cognizant of, that this is not an intentional thing, but it's a cultural thing. It's not a bad cultural thing.
No.
It needs to be taken into account.
Right. And with that comes education, but health messaging. And here we are using media to relay health messages. But there also can be the use of media in West Africa. Unfortunately, Hope Channel is not up there, so we physically can't do it. But there's Adventist World Radio, and then there's been talk of using a little portable radio, isn't there? And I think you've got one there.
Oh, this is a... It's called, and maybe a little irreverently, the God Pod, but it's solar charged and MP4 player, and it can be used in the villages, and messages can be recorded and people can listen to it and recharge it. And it's pretty sturdy, about $14 a piece, and we're hoping to get those out as well to get the message across of cleanliness, washing hands, being careful, early presentation, and you touched on something so crucial. Often when people go to the hospital and in this kind of critical condition die, people say, if you go to hospital, you go to die. So rather stay away. Mm. And also the separation is such a huge issue. And that kind of information, we've got to also realize that we're dealing with, as was mentioned earlier, war-torn countries which are surviving and coming out of those issues. They're coming out of economic issues. And for them, illiteracy is a big issue. Mm. So the way the messages are given, hugely important.
Right, and Adra's right there giving health messages. Tell us how you're doing that.
We're actually doing it in a variety of different ways, but in all of the different messaging, we are focusing on a relationship approach.
Absolutely.
We want to be sure that, for example, if someone from another country were to come and tell me to change something that's intrinsically part of my behavior, my everyday habits, there's nothing to say that I should listen to that person. How do I know that they know what they're talking about? So building that relationship, starting that one-on-one human contact, but in addition to that, tapping into human relationships that already exist and that are already trusted. For example, the network of religious leaders that are already in country, part of the culture, they understand the people, they have those relationships. If we can communicate with them, get them to understand the messaging, and they can communicate it to their communities.
Right, and you're using pictographs a lot, aren't
you? Absolutely, yes.
I want to thank Deborah Olson for being on the show. In our next segment, one of her colleagues will join us, and right after the break, we'll get into some immune-boosting exercise. But first, this. In Matthew 24 and Luke 21, Jesus warned us pestilences would strike just before his second coming.
pestilences like Ebola. So in the midst of this destruction, Ebola can stand as a reminder that a better world is coming, that we can wait in joyful expectation. Looking into the future, the Apostle John wrote in Revelation 20, God will wipe away all tears from our eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things will pass away. In the midst of pain, fear, and loss, this prophecy may seem unbelievable. Perhaps that's why the angel told John to write this down, for these words are true and faithful. It's reassuring to have the certainty that a better day is soon to come, when Ebola, cancer, and every other disease will be no more. And until that day, why not rest in the assurance that God is in control presently, and what He has planned for you is better than you could ever imagine? Will you choose to trust Him right now? We're back and it's time to get moving because Sean's here. Hey. Hi, Sean.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. It's that time again. What are we going to do?
Okay, so I get a lot of questions from people who, you know, bump into me and they say, how do I lose weight? I'm like, you know, you got to work for it.
Yep.
Okay, so I'm going to show you a really quick way of throwing some high intensity training into just a normal routine, which is great for the body, during the workout and post-workout. That's the key, to work out to that level where you're burning calories up to 24 hours post-workout.
Right.
Okay, so if you're at the gym, jump on the treadmill, do some jumping jacks if you choose. If you're at the park, you know, get warmed up. But again, getting the body ready. I'm gonna show you two ways of doing mountain climbers, okay? One is we're gonna go down to the ground, keep the hands right here, and we're gonna start with the regular traditional mountain climber. All right, core tight. And before you start, this is the neutral position right here. Your hips are not high. Can you show me how the hips will look high? We don't want it right there. Down right there and then begin. Go ahead, boom. So you keep going for about 30 seconds. Okay, make sure you are breathing. The heart rate is gonna start to go up. If you hold your breath, it goes up even higher, okay? Now, if you were to get a little, if this is the first time you're doing this, please take your time, okay? You're in a position where you're working your core, you're working your cardiovascular system, but you don't wanna, you know, overexert yourself. And now the crossbody, go right into it where you're taking that right knee and going toward, yes, there you go. This is a little bit more challenging and this is the upgrade to the mountain climber. So give me about five more, five, four, three, two, and one. And what I want you to do is now that your heart rate is up, now we're gonna go into the more strength building exercise, the plank, okay?
All right.
So now we're building core strength, all right? So here, hands are relaxed. Your spine is neutral. Look down to about right here. The spine is neutral. And if I were to push you, your body would be nice and rigid, okay? This is what you want. This is the plank. It is a great way to burn calories. Are you feeling the challenge? The
burn? I am.
You feeling the burn?
I'm feeling the burn.
Already?
After all those mountain climbs.
Okay, there you go. So here it is. We're going to
continue. That was the 13th take, remember?
That was. So here we go. And then how do you upgrade this? You turn it right to the side. Put your hand right here. And even if, actually go on your leg like this, right? Now what you could do is just go up on one leg, mm-hmm. right? Keep it there, perfect. And keep the core tight. Now put that hand up just a little bit and there you go. Now you went from a mountain climber where you increased the heart rate, the plank where you built strength, and here is a little bit more of a challenging plank position,
right.
Which again will help build core strength.
Because you gotta keep balance.
You gotta keep balance. Try the other side real quick. See how that goes.
I'm gonna turn my back.
All right, you can do it. Give me five, four, three, great plank, two, and one, good job. Again, you wanna challenge yourself. You wanna be able to, you know, bring up that heart rate and think about post-workout. You know, how is your body gonna adapt? If you're still sweating after you work out, great job.
Right.
Still burning calories.
And these big muscles?
Yes.
You're just going to burn them that much faster.
Yes. Total body exercise is a great way to maximize your time, you know, 10, 15 minutes, and you could reap the benefits.
Now, how do we stretch those?
All right, muscles? Let's go. So while we're here, let's stretch the calf. Feet down.
Okay.
Right there. And then what I want you to do is walk your feet to your hands. Come up nice and slow. Open and close. Take a nice deep breath. Finish off your workout. Big circle. And guess what? You are done. Good job.
Don't fall asleep. There's still more to watch. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
Which is better for your bones, dairy or soy milk? As we age, our risk of developing osteoporosis increases, and our dietary choices can make a big difference. The Adventist Health Study found women drinking milk at least once a day had bones that were just as strong whether they drank soy milk or dairy milk. Those drinking milk less than once a day had a significantly higher risk of osteoporosis. Maintaining strong bones is another ageless advantage.
And now your questions. Avril emailed, what are probiotics and prebiotics? The intestines have bacteria living inside them. Some bacteria are helpful to maintain good health and digestion. And probiotics are these good germs. You can buy them or you can find them in cultured food like yogurt. Prebiotics are the fiber type components in foods that the good germs like. So it can be helpful to eat the foods that contain them when you're taking probiotics. And common foods include garlic, onions, whole wheat flour, asparagus, tomatoes, bananas. And then there are more exotic foods that are rich in them, like Jerusalem artichokes, dandelion greens and chicory root, even the stalks of mushrooms. Anesia posted in on Facebook, what can I do naturally to boost my immune system? Well, there are a number of things. You can eat a highly nutritious diet with lots of green leafy vegetables, legumes, onions, garlic. Avoid the sugar and the processed foods. Then have 30 minutes moderate activity every day. That really boosts your natural killer cells and your general immune system. Drink plenty of water so that your mucous membranes don't dry out and become cracked and are more likely to let viruses in. Or bacteria, and add some of those probiotics to your diet. I like a compound called Dalimmune that's a probiotic-based supplement, and it's good at preventing infections. Other preventers might include 2 to 4 grams of vitamin C each day or echinacea. They help prevent the common cold. They won't help prevent every viral infection. And then hydrotherapy that raises the body temperature, like sitting in a steam tent. That can also boost the immune system. Remember to go outdoors and get some nice sunshine and be sure that your vitamin D levels are up high enough to fight these infections. Vitamin D is really important for the immune system. Be sure to get your sleep 7 to 9 hours a day and have a rest day every week. Meditation is also important. It gives the immune system a real boost. And finally, stay away from sick people. Someone else called and asked, how do I lose belly fat? Well, you have to lose it all over. But specifically for belly fat, reduce stress and stop all those processed foods. You'll lose it more easily. And don't get tricked into buying supplements that are out there. You know, a small amount of extract is not going to combat a whole lifestyle that predisposes towards weight gain. So 3 tips for weight loss. Eat 3 whole food plant-based meals a day with nothing in between and make the evening meals small. Don't drink calories, just plenty of water. And don't buy anything that comes in a crinkly wrapper like snacks or chips. Thanks for those questions. Remember, you can phone, email, text or Facebook. And now it's time to go shopping. Celery is a winter crop with a mild aromatic taste. That makes it perfect for soups and casseroles. And it adds a delicate flavor and works well with onions and carrots. Compared to other veggies, celery is high in sodium, with 90 milligrams in 1 cup. Though that's still much less than the daily limit of 2,300 milligrams. Many people use celery as a weight loss snack because 1 cup contains only 20 calories. It has several B vitamins, which are good for dealing with stress, and celery seed, which is sold as a spice, contains a compound that lowers blood pressure. To avoid wilting, keep celery well wrapped.
However, if it does wilt, just trim off the end, set it in a bowl of ice-cold water, and pretty soon it'll be sitting up crunchy and crisp again. It keeps in the refrigerator for up to 7 weeks, during which time the inner stalks will continue to grow. Now that's what I call live food. Perfect for juicing. Bon appetit.
Now joining Dr. Peter Landless as a guest on today's show is David Holdsworth, Director of Emergency Response for ADRA International. He is their coordinator for Ebola in West Africa. I asked Dr. Landless to give us an update on the status of the two Seventh-day Adventist hospitals in West Africa.
Waterloo Hospital in Sierra Leone was closed down because of Ebola cases. It is now being refurbished by the government and used as an Ebola treatment centre, as a holding centre and a treatment centre. So it is now being run by the government authorities for that purpose. Monrovia, Liberia, the Cooper Hospital, has been running flat out as a non-Ebola hospital ever since the beginning of this crisis. We've been very blessed to have outstanding physicians who have worked extremely hard and a very dedicated staff. Unfortunately, approximately 3 weeks ago, one of the staff members contracted Ebola, and in the tracing setup was found that this was contracted in the community when she was helping individuals in the community with the illness. So the hospital has been closed with a self-imposed quarantine. We'll be reopening probably early to mid-November. There are physicians lined up. Adventist Health International and Loma Linda have been working very hard, along with the church headquarters, to get people lined up to go, and that's the plan, to get started again, hopefully around about 10th, 15th of November.
And the reason for it being a non-Ebola hospital is all the others are swamped with Ebola, so this one can stay clean and deal with all the other trauma and everything else.
Absolutely, and it's played a huge role. Even the president of the country went to visit one of the patients who was seen there for major trauma. It's very much appreciated, but doing a sterling job, very difficult circumstances, and the people are working extremely hard.
Now, David, faith-based entity, does it have credibility in this environment and these communities?
Actually, our association as ADRA with the Seventh-day Adventist Church is a strength. And because we're so present as a denomination in the communities, ADRA has a better entree in working with community leaders at the county level and at the local level.
So that's your end. You work with the local leaders, tribal leaders, county leaders, and what are you actually doing at that level now?
We have two main programs that are going on in Liberia at this time. One is a health messaging, health promotion program that's in Bome County, which is mostly Muslim. And I think it goes back to the conversation you were having before, where these are cultures where things change very slowly. And so the program that we're implementing is definitely using the local health ministry, the local community leaders, whether they're tribal or whether they're appointed or elected democratically, to use their offices as an entree into these communities. And our programs have been very well received by the communities at large. We've been working in about 300 communities within Bome County with about 15,000 beneficiaries. The other major program that we're doing is a food distribution in three different counties in Liberia. This is in cooperation with the World Food Program. We're distributing about 10 million metric tons of food. Actually, it's 10,000. I'm sorry. 10,000 metric tons of food to Ebola-impacted families. This, too, has been very well received because it is now the time of the harvest, and some of these families are not able to get into the fields to gather their harvest at this time.
Wow. Now, Dr. Landless, how many Seventh-day Adventists have died of Ebola in West Africa?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's probably less than 20 we know of.
Yet the church is investing an awful lot of resource, so that is going to that community, not to its own constituents.
Absolutely, and that's our role. We ought to be relevant in the community. The people who are affected and infected are the ones that we really have to work hard for. And so it's our privilege and our opportunity to work seamlessly as the church, as ADRA, Hope for Humanity, Loma Linda, Adventist Health International, have been working as a seamless group, focusing on bringing relief to a very, very sadly affected area. And it's something which we need to realize is not that far removed from us, although we shouldn't panic. We need to realize there are real people who are suffering in this situation.
Absolutely. Now, as a humanitarian actor in this play, you deal with not just health issues with ADRA. What are your other issues out there? You mentioned the food program. What else are these Liberians dealing with?
Yeah, it is the case that this is the period when the harvest is due, and we are working in several counties in Liberia to increase their capacity to grow food. A lot of this has to do with refugees that have come from other countries, but it is the case that we also are building the capacity of the local people in Liberia. Household gardens, which add variety to their diets, and also livelihoods training to give them better skills to serve, to earn funds for their family survival.
Right, because we're talking here about whole states going down, so economically very difficult times for Liberia.
Yes.
After the break, we have more from Dr. Landless and David Holdsworth, so stay with us. Cooper Seventh-day Adventist Hospital is situated in Liberia's capital city, Monrovia, where the Ebola epidemic is raging. Here's a report from the New York Times of a neighboring Ebola treatment hospital.
Outside the John F. Kennedy Hospital in Monrovia, Liberia, 20-year-old Ibaga Stiwo is sick.
Oh, Dao. Brother, what would you know?
His parents wait beside him. All signs point to the late stages of Ebola, the deadly virus that's killed more than 2,300 across West Africa.
He just vomiting, he toiling, vomiting, he eat, he vomit. You're gonna get it, people back.
As sick as he is, he won't be allowed inside. The largest hospital in the nation, and many others just like it, are completely full.
But I want to tell you, any hospital now will go to the same one. They say we should wear the title should come.
This is Ben C. Solomon in Monrovia, Liberia. This city of 1.5 million is the first major metropolitan area to face an Ebola outbreak since the virus was discovered in 1976. Hundreds have died here since the outbreak began in May. And the World Health Organization expects thousands of new cases in the coming weeks. With a limited number of hospital beds and personnel to treat the sick, many of the infected are left to die at the hospital gates.
It's heartbreaking. There's nothing I can do about it because I have no space, I don't have the capacity.
Local and foreign-run treatment centers alike are unable to cope with the surge. Here at the Doctors Without Borders Treatment Center, they too are at capacity.
What we're looking at here is about a 350-bed hospital. No one has done this before. To turn people away at the door that are sick, that is a new experience and a difficult one to handle because we are full every day. We are not capable of building fast enough.
10 to 15 die each day here, but their beds quickly filled. The virus is spreading fast among families in Monrovia's slums, and with an incubation period over several weeks, no one knows exactly how many more patients will arrive in the months ahead.
If you look back in time, MSF have been able to cope with outbreaks that have been going on from year to year because they have been small. But at the moment, we are down on our knees. So who else is there?
After a few hours outside, a crowd formed around Ibaga and his family.
Yeah, where are people going to be talking about bringing people to the hospital?
Many were angry, urging them to go home.
They say because of the virus, the people will not look at us, so we should carry them back to the hospital.
The hospital worker finally came out to calm the crowd.
The war is full. No capacity. You understand?
So I did not liberate. But the forward view of GFK is very big.
Later in the afternoon, Ibaga was finally admitted. But for his family, what comes next remains a mystery.
Every day they're making announcement. When you get a sick patient, report a sick patient. Same with you. Nothing they are done. Wait. We're waiting. We don't know what to do.
What can you do when the need is simply overwhelming and resources so limited? Friends, we need to respond to this tragic situation. Drastic measures are needed to stop it in West Africa now. Stop it there and you prevent it everywhere else. To that end, I asked Dr. Landless which entities have been involved in the concerted effort that he is overseeing to get aid into West Africa.
The primary entities involved are the church administration itself. That's been helping to supply the budgets for the doctors who are there and, of course, the hospital to an extent as well. Adventist Health International. Dr. Hart from Loma Linda, who's the president of Loma Linda, who also is the president of Adventist Health International, they've been working day and night to ensure that we at least have physicians ready and able to go as needed and to support them in the field, and also to keep the hospital functioning efficiently as a non-Ebola hospital. Then we have ADRA. I'm most grateful for ADRA. ADRA has done a tremendous amount of work helping to get, because of their infrastructure and their footprint, to get essential medical equipment, personal protective equipment into Liberia, into the areas, into Sierra Leone for the assistance in this whole effort. Then, of course, there are other role players as well. There's Hope for Humanity, Adventist Community Services, who've now started to raise funds together. There's been a seamless collaboration, cooperation, and partnership. And this is wonderful. There are too many silos. We've had a wonderful collaboration for which I'm very thankful.
Now, David, looking at the dark side, there's been a lot of death. There must be psychosocial needs out there. There must be children who've lost parents, parents who've lost children. What's happening in that arena?
Yeah, there is a crying need in all the areas that you just mentioned. As an element of the program that we were discussing earlier around health messaging, there is an element of that program that speaks to psychosocial interventions. However, we need more assistance in that area. It is a crying need. It's well documented by the WHO and other players that are on the ground. The orphans are a particular issue because often, as has been discussed, the whole family may be lost, and a child is left sitting outside of an Ebola treatment center alone. There are agencies that take on that role, and ADRA is working in close cooperation with them to make sure these children are taken care of and placed with the extended family.
To stop the spread, we need to talk about containment. Do we need to stop flights going in and out of the country? You're talking about having doctors standing by to fly in, but how does that all work?
That's such a hot potato, and it's a politically hot potato. If you stop people coming out of the country, you can't very well send people into the country. Do we need surveillance? Sure. Do we need monitoring? Absolutely. Do we need to be careful about it? Yes. Do we need to be sensitive? Yes. Should we be draconian? No. What we need to do is we need to be cautious. There are many, many restrictions put in place. There's monitoring in place. And I think that what is being done is what should be done. Containment is going to take more than political argument. It's going to take what are commonly called boots on the ground to get the issues resolved. This is not a short-term issue. The reconstruction, the rebuilding that has already been alluded to so graphically by ADRA representatives here, is going to be something which is going to take time. We're in for the long haul. So the odd donation here and there is not going to be enough. There's going to have to be a consistent, intentional support, ongoing, for those orphans to and for families mm-hmm. who cannot work at the moment, cannot get out to school, they cannot do their normal businesses. It's really a huge problem, which living in the situation we find ourselves is very difficult to even imagine.
David, what do you see when it all has stopped? What are going to be the greatest needs of these countries?
I think what the WHO and the CDC are all saying is this may never stop. That Ebola is probably embedded within these communities, and like other countries where Ebola continues to pop up, like the Democratic Republic of Congo, we could see these resurgences on a periodic basis. And so one of the major areas that we've been discussing here has been healthcare, and certainly the capacity of the denomination together with other ADRA and other partners needs to focus on that, and I know that's something that's near and dear to Dr. Landless's heart. But there are other activities within these communities that we need to return to strengthen them, education. The schools are closed. Mm-hmm. There are no social gatherings at this mm-hmm. point to protect the populations. The agricultural development and capacity of these countries is greatly limited. And it is the case that there are economic barriers right now. Many borders are closed. That means no trade is taking place. That means these economies are broken. And it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money to rebuild these countries for the long term and bring them back to the level of development that they had before.
Thank you, gentlemen. We've run out of time. It's been wonderful having you on the show. Very serious subject. And thank you for what you are doing, each one of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The situation is desperate. Schools have been closed for months. Food is scarce. This year's crops still stand in the fields. Businesses, government offices are closed, and the entire economy is suffering. The limited health resources are being swallowed up by just one disease, Ebola. Meanwhile, people with malaria, trauma, infections, even childbirth have nowhere to go. Though in Monrovia, they have Cooper, Seventh-day Adventist Hospital. In rural areas, villagers have no access to soap or chlorine. All they have is water in which to wash. That's no protection from this deadly virus. ADRA is working night and day to provide education, sanitation, and hygiene facilities. In the words of Christ, as you have done it for one of the least of these, you have done it for me. For information on how you can help, go to our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy, and find an entity in your location. That's all for me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.